This is from the Washington Post, June 12th. There's five reporters on it. Jessica Contrera, Gene Abelson, John Harden, Hayden Godfrey, and Nate Jones. It's called Abused by the Badge. A Washington Post investigation found hundreds of law enforcement officers in the United States have sexually exploited kids. Many avoid prison time. They serve in police departments big and small. They were new recruits and seasoned veterans, patrol officers and chiefs of police. They understood the power of their guns and badges. In many cases, they used that very power to find and silence their victims. A Washington Post investigation has found that over the past two decades, hundreds of law enforcement officers in the United States have sexually abused children, while officials at every level of the criminal justice system have failed to protect kids, punish abusers, and prevent additional crimes. Police and sheriff's departments have enabled predators by botching background checks, ignoring red flags, and mishandling investigations. Accused cops have used their knowledge of the legal system to stall cases, get charges lowered, or evade conviction. Prosecutors have given generous plea deals to officers who admitted to raping and groping minors. Judges have allowed many convicted officers to avoid prison time. All the while, children in every state and the District of Columbia have continued to be targeted and groomed and violated by officers sworn to keep them safe. Cases like these are not unique. The Post identified at least 1,800 state and local law enforcement officers who were charged with crimes involving children and sexual abuse from 2005 through 2022. Reporters spent more than a year unearthing thousands of court filings, police reports, and other documents to understand who these officers are, how they gain access to children, and what is and isn't being done to stop them. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is a very special episode of the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Everybody, we're celebrating 300 episodes today. And as Carl always says, we haven't missed a week. So we started. Have not missed a week. Now, even during a certain trial that Bill and I were covering, we went every day. Because we had to do that. We committed to it.
We could have, like, banked those for subsequent weeks, but you didn't do that.
No. We're pros. We're real pros. And to honor that work, we wanted to bring you a special guest, somebody who was intimately involved in those stories, Steve Wood, Esquire. Steve, how are you?
Oh, it's great to be here. Only a little weird, but...
You feeling okay? We tried to give you all the drinks and all that stuff, and, you know...
Well, like our mutual mentor, the late, great, retired dean of Gonzo Journalism would say, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. So here we are.
That's it. Yes. That's it. We made it. We made a Raoul Duke reference in a couple weeks ago. Yeah. So
excellent.
So I told you, I didn't actually have too many sort of particular questions about the trial or that sort of that matter. But I did want to ask a few because I think they're like, they're really interesting.
Far away. You guys were there every day, so yeah. you know it as well as anybody.
Yes, and that's what I was going to tell you. This never really came up, and you did a very good job right at the beginning of sort of in the opening statement saying, you know, we're not assessing, you know, the person or the boss or the manager or whatever. Fair enough. I thought that was good. But the one felony of the five counts original, the five original charges, the one felony was intimidation of witnesses, and I listened to all of the prerequisites and the timing and all of that, and I would have been, I had you dead to rights on that. And I don't know how anybody, didn't. I don't know, but I mean, you certainly, I think, approached it in a way that I think was very smart. We were there every day. We tracked it. We were like, okay, she did this behavior on this date. I mean, we had a spreadsheet where we were like, because we paid very close attention to what the law was. If we were jurors, we looked at it like if we were jurors, what would we do? And, man, you saved the day somehow on that because that looked dead to rights to me.
Well, glad you weren't on the jury. I honestly see it the opposite way. I thought of all of the charges, that was the one that represented the greatest overreach, because there was just a temporal disconnect, right? The law is pretty clear that in order to, and common sense leads you to this place too, that in order to intimidate a witness, you have to have some level of awareness that you're under investigation and some level of awareness that the person is a witness. And we argued to the jury, and apparently the jury agreed, that there just wasn't any evidence that, as to the large majority of it, that there wasn't no evidence that Kathy McGinnis knew she was under investigation. There was no evidence that she knew who witnesses against her might be. And in fact, and the Delaware Supreme Court mentioned this in their opinion, that there was even evidence introduced at trial by the state of things that happened before the investigation even began. And, you know, without going too far down a philosophical rat hole, in our system, we say that crimes are defined by statute, as opposed to a judge saying, okay, well, here's what I think the crime is, which is the way it's done in some countries and the way it was once done here, and I mean in colonial times. And the statute's pretty clear, and the evidence they produced didn't meet the statutory test. But that's a long-winded way of saying, I'm really glad you guys weren't on the jury, if that's what you
mean. Yeah, I mean, we just looked at it like, and I guess... Well, I mean, we wouldn't have been on the jury because, unlike you, which I found fascinating, you know, we were kind of like, we followed her, sort of her social media and like her political life to some extent. So we wouldn't have ever been. So, you know, I already sort of knew about her, so I wouldn't have been on. But she was doing, and maybe this is me sort of projecting onto it, but she was doing things that are very suspicious. Like the piece of evidence of her, looking at all of the emails and monitoring live emails. And when they said, well, and somebody in DTI got fired for this because that's weird stuff. She was doing like 20, 30, I don't remember the number, dozens, we'll say, you might remember. And I think of all of the other managers that had this, there were only two people being, you know, sort of surveilled or whatever you want to say. That, but again, maybe she's just a very paranoid person. Maybe she's like Nixonian in some degree. I don't know. But there were things like that, things like the way she handled some phone calls and pauses and the way other people, the way she separated the office between people who are close to her and invited to the parties and she's looking at with other people. That's classic sort of like get your stuff together. But is she just doing that because she's, you know, did she know she was under investigation or is that just how she operated, I guess? I don't know.
Well, that matters, right? So if, you know, if you walk across the street and you flip somebody off because you don't like them, that's one thing. But if you walk across the street and you do it because you know or you think you might be under investigation and you think there's that maybe that person is cooperating, that's a completely different thing. And the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's the second thing, that you know you're under investigation, that's why you're doing it, and that didn't happen. So, you know, you mentioned the Ms. McGinnis's monitoring of emails. The evidence came out at trial that the employees whose email was being monitored didn't know it was happening. So how am I intimidating a witness if I'm doing something that the witness doesn't know I'm doing? So it's super important in criminal law. And I guess, so here's another philosophical bent, but the purpose of the criminal law being reduced by statute and then sticking a jury between the accused and the power of the government, I think is essentially based on the fear of the framers that if left unchecked, the criminal justice system would be used routinely to silence political opponents. And you know, if you look around the world, the criminal justice system in lots of other places is routinely used to silence political opponents. So that means somebody can't be prosecuted just because of who they are or because we don't like them. That's incredibly dangerous.
I would argue my issue is, and I think there is a tradition of like, oh, you know, we don't want to have some sort of place to where we do lawfare all the time. And
right.
That's coming up now, obviously, with the stuff that's going on in the political sort of judicial realm. I don't really care about that stuff. What I'm concerned about is that the criminal justice, that doesn't make it like perfectly fair, because we still target people. We just don't target political opponents. We target basically poor people. We target, and we can get into this when we talk about your time at the AG, but we still target people. It's not blind. It's able to work in a certain way in certain aspects, and I think that's by design. That's what it's meant to do.
I think I agree with what I think you're saying. What I'm saying is that it shouldn't be, it can't be, and it, thank God it isn't enough to say, for whatever reason, I don't like that person, therefore I will prosecute them. What you have to do is say, at least, right, I don't like that person, and so I will investigate them and see if their conduct meets the elements of a particular criminal offense, and only then can I prosecute them. So that separation is critical, because otherwise the criminal justice system is bogus, and then, you know, it operates like it does in Russia right now, where they don't like you, so they'll just come up with a crime and you disappear. And I know that sounds like paranoid stuff, but look, in the fact of the matter is, in throughout much of human history and throughout much of the world even today, that's exactly the way the criminal justice system is used. And it's not used that way here. Now, we do say there's sometimes the definition of what a crime is something you might quarrel with because it might have a disproportionate impact. I get it. But that's a completely different thing than saying we're not going to bother to define crimes.
Well, there is discretion in there. So, you know, what types of crimes are we going to sort of, and this is sort of with the work with the legislature works into it too. Like, what types of crimes are we going to punish harshly? What type of crimes are we going to open up and be like, oh, we're going to add a few things to this to make sure it covers these other things? Mm-hmm. And then we're going to expand the use of this one.
Right.
Things like that.
Right.
That's kind of the thing that I'm talking about. But I will say this, and Bill and I think we're clear when we went through it, and even some of the other trials that we've covered a little bit since then, I've been nothing but impressed with the way the criminal court worked that we've seen.
Yeah.
The way the juries handled their work, the way the judges, whether it was in which other one did we see? Oh, the guy that was doing the Fox News defamation case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Judge Eric Davis.
Judge Eric Davis.
Emory law alum.
Hey, that's good research on your part. He sure is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
And he is an outstanding trial judge. He's right out of Central Casting.
Yeah.
You know, I won't say bad things about judges, and I have to be careful when I praise them. Well,
you don't want to give us all the dirt right here on these microphones?
And I have to be careful when I praise them, I guess, because someone could say I'm doing it for the wrong reasons, but credit where credit is due.
Yeah. I think it's blanket. Like I said, I went to the Sam Waters trial, the guy who slammed the cop who slammed the guy's head into the thing at the bodega in Southbridge.
Oh, right.
I went to that one. But everyone was just, you know, some manner of, it was, you didn't go in there thinking it was a circus. Like, even though sometimes you tried to create a circus for different reasons, but you knew that was like, that's how it had to go down.
So
I was really, I mean, just in general, I think both Bill and I were like, yeah, the system to some extent is at least fair once you get in there.
Yeah, with some caveats. But one thing I will say, and I'm not saying this because I'm a homer, I'm saying it because I actually think it's true. The Delaware judiciary, when compared to the judiciary of many other states, is outstanding. And you all have seen it. You can go up the road to Philadelphia, you know, if I'm going to trash something local, and watch a trial in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia, which is like our superior court, and you can come out of there think it looks like a bar scene from Star Wars. It just doesn't have any of the professionalism or decorum that really is a hallmark of the Delaware bar. And some of that is because we've been brainwashed, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Into thinking we're special and should be. And some of it is really because our judges are, on the whole, really excellent. And you know, one of the reasons that all of the Delaware has such preeminence in corporate law, for instance, is because I've learned this now through my teaching around the country, but the Delaware Court of Chancery is widely respected by lawyers around the country as being as good as it gets. That's not just me saying that. That's what people in other
why are we trying to overturn Molis before the Supreme Court gets there? You know, that's the thing. I will say this, and maybe this is a good time to get to the corporate side because it is, you mentioned it to Bill.
Right.
There is a very sort of cultish nature to it.
Yep.
Where, you know, which is, you know, on one hand, I think you're correct. I mean, all the trial judges that we've seen, or the Chancellor McCormick or Vice Chancellor Laster, like, they're all great. But the bar that's behind them is a little bit, well, it's not a little bit. It's a cliquey sort of club.
That's true.
Know? I mean, on one hand, you're right. You have a reason to brag because you have a lot of heavyweights or very professional lawyers in the bar that do complicated stuff, do worldwide stuff,
right.
All that. I get that. But at some point, you had to be a little humble. We do live in a democracy, after all. And so you gotta try to humble, you know, just leave your ego at the door a little bit and be like, hey, you know what? Maybe we can take a breath. You know, we're not the fucking gods of the world here, and sort of step back because that's what's happening in the corporate side, I think.
Yes, Steve. Well, if I could say, if there's a word to describe the bar uses to generally describe itself, it starts with a C. Could you guess what that is?
Collegial,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
I think I just wanted to echo that. I mean, that's something that we spoke with Lauren from Chancery Daily last week. Although, and with the caveat that I do think things have felt a little different, like the last 10 or 15 years.
I think that's right. I think we all think that, actually.
Yes,
for sure. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, you talked about the cliquish nature of it. It's, you know, cliquish is a loaded word. Here's the analogy that I would use. Right. What a lot of people don't understand, I know you guys do, is that the bar everywhere and in Delaware is sort of carved up into subspecialties, right? It's not like it was 50 years ago where most of the big dog lawyers dabbled in most things. Now people are carved up into subspecialties. And so that means when you talk about I'll call them the pros, the people in the Delaware bar who specialize in litigation in the Delaware Court of Chancery, you know, there's probably only, I'm going to guess here, right? You back me up here, Bill, maybe 300-400 of them at the most, if that many.
I want to say, well, the corporate section was much larger than I thought it was. I read 500 strong the other day. So that makes sense.
All right. And then of the people of that section who are experienced and do a lot of that work and who might be thought of as influential in any way is probably like half that,
10%,
right?
10% or...
And so... Yeah. Right. And so it's not so much a click that... Because anybody can gain admission to it if they do the work. It's just a small group of people who happen to practice in an area of law that has outsized consequences. That's the way I see it. I had an outsider's perspective, right? I spent 31 years as a criminal prosecutor. And honestly, in that 31 years, I think I was in the Court of Chancery for a proceeding like twice. And we just thought of it as a place where we thought, wow, this is weird. Nobody uses profanity here and the suits are expensive. It just had nothing to do with what we did. But I left employment of the state. I went to McCarter and English. Within the first 2 weeks, I was involved in a Court of Chancery trial in front of Vice Chancellor Laster. And I don't want to say I'm an accepted member of that bar. That's a big, gross overstatement. But people have been friendly and respectful to me, and that's all you can ask for. And certainly I've been treated by the court with nothing but respect. So it is a weird... I But the thing is,
I would be in dereliction of duty not to mention, since, you know, we've talked to Lauren. I work very closely. I mean, you know, I work inside the,
right.
the ODS,
right?
Just help on a, basically a special project,
right?
Police reform project.
Right.
But I work very closely with Misty Siemens,
right.
who supervises the family court part
right.
of it,
right?
And both of them happen to be women. You're like a white guy.
Yep.
And so the fact that all of them sort of say there is a hierarchy, there's a sort of a male-dominated hierarchy. Lauren said it the other day that because people are starting to accept sort of the progress and the changes, but they see a woman running the chancery,
mm-hmm.
The Court of Chancery, and they're like, I don't know about this. And so that's the part of it, that hierarchical part of it, that I think is the part that we have to, that needs to be sort of looked at and addressed.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think I agree with some of what you said. The Delaware bar was significantly more male dominated when I joined it in the mid 80s than it is now. There's no question. It's changing. There's no question about it. And, you know, you yourself just noted that our chancellor is a woman, right? Where we really have a problem is the Delaware bar is so incredibly monochromatic when it comes to race that it's horrifying. We all know it. I could go on at great lengths about the causes of it. I can tell you that when I was in the administration in the Delaware Department of Justice, we beat our heads against the wall trying to diversify ourselves. And it's really not just race. It's also economic background. And, you know, in America, a lot of times those two things are conflated and confused, so it's hard to tell what you're looking at. But it was frustrating. Every year we'd go out, and actually when I was working with Attorney General Brady, I'm proud of my role in this, we started a law clerk recruitment program. And we were recruiting from Boston, law schools from Boston to Atlanta, for the specific purpose of trying to become more diverse. And every year our law clerk class would be, you know, 15 to 25% people of color. And then when it came time to make job offers, we would lose all of the clerks we really wanted to hire because we just weren't paying enough, right? So if you were a qualified applicant who was a person of color and we wanted to start you at $50,000 a year, you're coming out of law school with, I don't know what, $150,000, $200,000 debt that is payable on day one. And stuffy and pompous down the street is going to pay you $150. And I think that has a lingering effect in the composition of the bar, because lots of young lawyers want to start in public service, and it's untenable here. The salaries are too low. We don't have a state-funded public service loan deferment program, which makes Delaware unique. Now, this could be wrong, because the information I'm about to give you is, 10 years old or so. I wrote legislation at the request of Attorney General Biden to start a public service loan deferment program, which P.S. went nowhere because it cost money. And at the time I wrote it, when we did the research,
imagine the fiscal note on that.
Well, we, right.
Fiscal note, yeah, must have been.
We actually wrote it backwards. We said, to try to get around the fiscal note, that there would be a cap on the program that would be determined by the yearly appropriation, so that
just give us whatever you
just
can.
We'll take anything.
Yeah, right. Another classic. Just please, clever. Please, sir.
Right.
Alms for your bitty.
Give me your fucking scraps.
Yeah,
can you escheat a bit more this year, sir?
Yeah.
Have we gotten control of any more unused gift cards?
But
no, we gave those to the port.
Yeah. I do have to applaud the work of Chief Justice Seitz in this area. He's spoken about it a lot, and he has done two things which may help. The first is, Delaware was the only state in the United States until this year, it only offered the bar once a year. And so most competitor states offer two or three times a year. And so the practical consequence of that is you get hired by a law firm or the Attorney General's office, and you're going to be at a lower salary till you pass the bar, right? So let's say you fail it. Well, if you're in Pennsylvania, no big deal. I'll just take it again in 2 months. I'm good to go. Except that's not true here. You got to wait a year. So you're working at that lower salary for a long period of time. And we had the highest required score on the multiple choice part of the exam, the multi-state, right, of any state in the United States. So what we were saying to people was, come take the hardest bar in the United States to pass. And oh, by the way, if you fail it, you're going to have to work at reduced wages for a year. And you can see...
Now, let me ask you a question.
It's brutal.
So that scheme, that system that had been in place... the once a year
thing. Let me just put in one more detail. There's also like a 3 or 4 month clerkship that more or less requires you to live in the state of Delaware.
Yeah, I'm okay with that part of it, but yeah.
I'm also,
but it's
as
an
well,
impediment for
but
sure.
It's a, yeah.
100%.
Impediment is a great way of putting it.
Yep, yeah. It is.
So what were the arguments when, I mean, there must have been, as this is Delaware,
right,
there must have been at least a decade of arguments saying, why do we do this once a year? And what was so? And while those arguments were happening, what were the people saying to say no? It's good, like the status quo sort of establishment people that did not want to change. What was their argument to keep it the way that you just described?
Okay,
it?
So the first thing is lawyers are pathological conservatives, small c, right?
Yeah.
So
hair splitters.
Yeah, but my gig is not one that rewards creativity. We do stuff because some dead English guy said 270 years ago, this is what you do, right? So there's that. But the other thing, which was a practical argument, is that the Delaware bar admission process is completely run by volunteer lawyers. And the Delaware bar is small as compared to those other states. And so the pool of volunteer lawyers is small. And the thought was, we just don't have the number of volunteers necessary to run it twice a year. And that argument was probably correct, and it's not my place to speak for the Chief Justice, but I think he just made a decision from the unique bully pulpit that only a Chief Justice can have in the bar to say, that may be a reason not to do it twice, but the cost we're paying for not doing it twice is just too much and we got to do it. You'd have to ask him that. I don't know. All I can say is it changed under the administration of this Chief Justice, and he's been pretty vocal about it. You can't go to a bar thing where the Chief Justice is speaking and not hear about it. His efforts to diversify the bar. And I shouldn't personify him that way. That's not right, because there are a lot of people in the bar, Bill, right? A lot of us are embarrassed by it and want to change it. But, you know, this is America, and until you get your way, money talks.
Yeah, right? And I think there's that money thing too. It's like, yeah, it's basically a money thing. We can't run it. And also, you get to, you know, and I don't know sort of the ins and outs of this, but if you're going to be on a low wage because you failed the first time, I don't know what percentage that is. And then also, how many of these folks stay, do all the grunt work for a year to do it again, and you can only pay them, you know, peanuts again.
Yep.
So that's a big incentive. That's another money incentive, right? I mean, I don't know how often that happens. Maybe somebody just says, fuck it, I'll try another state or whatever. But that's a money incentive too, is just to try to get people to do the grunt work for shit wages.
Well, I can only tell you from my experience in the AG's office about that thing. We would often lose people that we hired who had not yet passed the bar, who failed the Delaware bar, and then they take the Pennsylvania bar in the winter, and they pass it, and they leave because they're now admitted lawyers in Pennsylvania or New Jersey, who's our other competitor, and so they can get a raise. So it was a problem. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Well, let's get to some of your time at the Attorney General's office. The first thing I want to do is sort of harken back to what I read at the beginning, but I want to I want to tell a joke, but I want you to know that, as I said before, I think I'm not like picking on individual people. I'm just using this as an example to kind of get into the broader thing.
Yep.
You know, Frank Robinson won the MVP in both leagues. I think he won the batting championship in both leagues. I forget.
That sounds right.
Maybe the batting championship. I mean,
no, he's MVP in both leagues. But who was he traded for?
I forget.
Milt Pappas.
Milt Pappas. Ooh.
Wait, which player went which way?
Frank Robinson went from the Reds to the Orioles.
Yes, Milt Pappas he went Reds. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Perfect.
Because he was a Red. He was a National League player before.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things, and we'll go back to the trial a little bit. One of the things we had a good time with was our friend Frank Robinson, one of the investigators for the Attorney General's office, cop, basically. And how you were able to point out that. And this is one way, I find this interesting too, because this is one way that these sort of propaganda procedurals on TV actually do reflect what happens in real life. A lot of that stuff, especially like the court stuff, it doesn't really happen like that.
Yeah.
But the police stuff, like the interrogation stuff, does. And police are taught to be, you know, conniving little liars to get, because they think they've been convinced that what they're getting the bad guy. So they can be conniving little liars because that's the bad guy, right? And so you kind of went after the investigators in the McGinnis case, rightly so, I think, because they were they weren't being truthful about the purpose of their call or their questions or anything like that. And anybody who's seen any episode of Law and Order knows exactly how this works.
Right.
But for a very long time, you were relying on these people doing this.
Yep.
And, you know, you just code switch? You're like, yeah, I mean, they're conniving little liars, but we got to get these bad guys until you go on the other side and be like, you know what? I'm going to get your ass.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, elaborate on this dynamic?
So first I'll tell you this. I don't want to talk a lot about my personal feelings about the McGinnis trial because they're just not relevant.
And that's fine. And they're boring.
But I will tell you
this. And the reason I brought it up was just to introduce this other topic.
So I will tell you this. What was weird, a thing that was very weird for me about the McGinnis trial relates to my long service as a prosecutor. So Kathy Jennings was the attorney general who signed the indictment, right? My first or second mentor in the attorney general's office when I started in 1985 was Kathy Jennings. I tried my first murder trial with Kathy Jennings. I can't tell you how many hundreds of hours I spent in an office with Kathy Jennings discussing the right thing to do in cases or policies we ought to pursue or anything like that. Mark Denny, if I remember correctly, was one of the last people I hired when I was in the administration.
You mentioned that during the trial, actually, as well, a couple times, I think.
And I have total respect for both of them. And I have worked homicide cases with Frank Robinson before when I was prosecuting homicide. So that whole interplay was just weird and almost a little disassociative sometimes. But to your point, what I think I was trying to walk a fine line with the jury. What I was trying to do was to show that. Let me back up. I don't think there's anything wrong with police officers in the course of an investigation, I'll use the word lying about what they're doing and why they're doing it to the people they're talking to. I don't think there's anything wrong about that at all. Where I draw the line and where I try to draw the line in the case is, I think when you come to court, you got to own it. You got to say, yeah, I was lying because. You can't say, well, you know, I know it wasn't true, but it's not really a lie. No, stop. So that was the first point. And the second point, it laid against the facts of the case because the state was arguing, back to the aggravated act of intimidation charge, the state was arguing that McGinnis must have known that she was under investigation as of a particular day in June of 22?
Dude, you're not going to... It was 21.
Oh, 21.
21. June 21st, 2021, because of the phone call that had been made by Investigator Robinson. And the point I was trying to make was Investigator Robinson was telling people that he wasn't investigating Kathy.
Kathy Jennings and her daughter, they watch Law and Order, too. Like, everybody knows the cops are lying to you. So the fact that he was disingenuous about the reason for his call and he was just doing some audit on casual seasonal employees.
You said Kathy Jennings. I think you meant Kathy McGinnis, right?
What did I say?
You said Jennings. But I think you meant Kathy.
Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know.
Kathy's daughter's friend, Virginia, but hey.
Yeah,
I'm the McGinnis pedant.
Thank you for
tonight.
Reminding us.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, and you're correct.
It's up there somewhere.
So like when Virginia, she gets the call.
Right.
She calls Skylar or Sailor,
right,
or whatever.
Sailor.
Right. And because she immediately knows something's up. Even a 17-year-old kid knows when the cops call and they tell you something. It's they're lying, and so. Regardless of the fact that he said that, I don't think this is why I started by saying, like, yeah, you have to really suspend disbelief to believe that she had to be told in these words by a police officer, Auditor McGinnis, you're under investigation. Like, and anything before that somehow doesn't indicate that she knew.
No, so
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
I want to get back to the cop thing, but the
argument's kind of circular, because basically what the state was saying is that Kathy McGinnis knew she was doing wrong things, and therefore, when an investigator called, even though the investigator lied about why he was calling, Kathy McGinnis must have known she was under investigation. The first premise is flawed, right? What if she didn't think she was doing anything wrong, then why would she think she was being investigated? Reasonable minds can differ over that. The only point I'm trying to make is that you have to accept the first premise that she knew she was doing something wrong before any of the rest of it makes sense. And when you talk about what a 17-year-old kid must have thought, you know, although it was a while ago, I remember being 17, and what I remember about that was mostly that I was an idiot, and I think to try to...
Well, she did immediately call, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
That's the thing. Her doing that was indicative of... You're right. Like, I was a 17-year-old boy, and so I was, you know, I was like a baby.
Yeah, basically. Right.
But when the person who got that call immediately calls over and says, the cops are on us.
But that's not what they said.
Well,
what she said was that a police officer called me. What do I do? And it's kind of like, even to this day, even though I'm squeaky clean, you know, former prosecutor and all that, when a police officer pulls
know you're squeaky. By the way, we've had people telling you, by the right. way. Frank Robinson, yeah, because of what you did, Frank Robinson's been on your ass.
Yeah. Let me know if that's true, right? But when you see this, the lights go on and a police officer pulls me over, I'm nervous. I don't know why. I don't know what I did, but I'm nervous. And so I think to say that a 17-year-old would react any way other than that kid did, which was, oh, my God, a cop called me. I've never had a cop call me before. Mom, what do I do? And to imply a bunch of conscious thought after that, I think is just a bridge too far. And in any case.
Steve, you're you know what? You might have talked. If I was on the jury, you might have talked me into it.
Nah, I got no shot with you. But you weren't on the jury, and I'll take the verdict of the 12.
So let's get back to the police thing.
Right.
I mean, here's the other thing with right. with the cop thing, and we're relying on this. I think sort of like the bar.
Right.
The whole criminal justice system, at least the prosecutorial side.
Right.
Is under this impression that as long as we follow these lines and we can sort of say, like, well, we don't really know that, then we're off the hook. And so whatever the cops are doing, whatever they're doing, we don't want to really know that much about it. And because you must know that it's, you know, based on, for example, the Washington Post investigation that just came out today, this morning, I think. This is not one bad apple. We have systematic, and I'm not necessarily arguing like for police abolition or anything like that, like radical. I'm just saying we have to somehow come to a conclusion that it's not one bad apple. Well, we have an institution that's like kind of off on another, doing another thing, and we got to reel that in somehow.
I don't agree with that basic premise, and here's why.
Okay.
You got to be careful if you're going to skewer by anecdote, right? There are something like 200,000.
You're saying that Washington Post thing is an anecdote?
No, but here's the point I'm going to make. So you're a baseball fan, right?
Yeah.
Okay, small sample size. And this is what I mean by that. There are something like 200,000 police officers. And to say, I think if I remember what the Post story was, that over 10 years there were 1,800 police officers who were credibly accused of sexual assault.
Yep.
Right? That's...
On kids, so it's
okay,
narrow.
On kids.
Sexual assault on kids, 1,800 over 10 years.
Right. And so that's given that there's 200,000 police officers, and I don't know how many different police officers there would have been over a 10-year period of time. And are we saying that police officers commit sexual assault at a greater rate than average people?
Yes.
Well, but I don't think that article says that.
It doesn't. But I think we can go back and let's maybe it does or maybe it doesn't. Let's just say this. What if we found another? I can't, because 200,000 I can't think of nationally what there would be like near 200,000 of. Truck drivers has got to be way more. Postal workers, maybe? Is there 200,000 postal workers? Say there's 200,000 postal workers, and we found out that 1,800 of them in the last 10 years diddled kids. We'd be like, what the fuck is going on at the post office?
Well, but unless you compare it to other things,
Post office.
I'm not. I don't want to sound like I'm defending police officers who commit sexual assault. I'm not.
No, I think that's clear.
Right. I'm just questioning the methodology that's being used to skewer them. Here's where I'm coming from. There is a revered figure in the Delaware judiciary who's retired now. It's Judge Walt Stapleton, who ended his career on the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. And he was famous for interrupting lawyers in arguments and asking this question in particular, compared to what? That was always his question. He was always looking for context. And that always stuck with me. And I, you know, honestly, and I'm not trying to be funny, it's because you and I share a love for baseball. I think baseball got me there, right? So, Billy's hitting 400 against left-handers. Well, did he have 400 at bats or four, right? You want to know that kind of stuff. So this is what I think of police officers based on my own personal experience with them, which is anecdotal and not scientific. They, as a group, are some of the finest people you will ever meet. Are there bad cops? Yes. Do they make it difficult for everyone else in law enforcement? Yes. But I don't know what you could do credibly more while respecting people's general constitutional rights to ferret out the bad cops. Listen.
Here's what I'll say. I'm glad you asked that question.
Yeah.
Maybe it was rhetorical.
No, I'd like
to answer it.
No.
Here's the tricky part.
Yep.
If you asked me compared to what, I would say, you know what? I'd like to tell you, but the police won't allow us in a democratic society to go look and see what the fuck they're up to. Right? The misconduct records. So I'll give you an example. Well, first of all, we don't even have to talk about what they did with our Leobor reform last year. You know, they gutted it and, you know, they made a few changes, a few cosmetic changes, and this is where we are. Fine. That's fine. Let's put that aside. This year, we got fucked last year. All we want is to say criminal defense attorneys at trial can get police misconduct records the way that civil attorneys can get under the rules of evidence at trial, so the judge decides. It's not public even.
Mm-hmm.
Not even public.
Right.
Not even public so that we could make the so we could say compared to what. This is just for them to use as they would use other private, you know, information like autopsy or crime scene photos or anything like that. The police don't want us to be able to answer the question that the judge posed compared to what. We can't compare it to anything because they investigate themselves, they keep it all secret, and they bury it. You know, 205 and 206 said that the Post Commission was supposed to send misconduct reports to the Criminal Justice Council. Right?
Right.
So you know how many misconduct reports they got? One. They got the guy from tobacco and alcohol that was stealing the cigarettes for drugs.
Yeah, the one that there were like newspaper stories.
Yeah, about. The one. There's one. So they have one credible misconduct record in the last 9 months.
Well,
they don't want us to. They don't want us to answer the question that you asked.
I'll tell you what.
Very suspicious.
It makes sense to me that when a police officer testifies in a trial, that substantiated reports of misconduct that even broadly defined relate to his or her credibility ought to be available to the defense attorney. And it makes sense to me that those kinds of things should be public. Now, you said reports, And I don't know. So I would draw a pretty sharp line between allegations and mere allegations and sustained allegations. I mean, we don't report mere arrests of people. We only report convictions. So I don't know.
Who only reports them? Not the newspaper.
Well, I forget the newspaper.
Not what's public. I mean, we report. They put WDEL puts fucking mugshots online.
Yeah.
So let's, you know, I'm just, again, I feel the vibe of what you're saying, but what I'm saying is there's a two-tiered sort of, like, understanding of, like, well, we have to give everybody their civil rights, and we don't want to go too far, you know, we don't want to find out too much about what we're doing, but that doesn't apply to anybody else.
Well, what I'm saying is that, in general, we ought to apply the same rules across the board, right? So I don't think police officers should be given less civil rights than anybody else, but I don't think they should be given more either. That's just my personal opinion. All I can tell you is it's easy for me to defend police officers in general, having worked with them for 30 years, because they, not all of them, but most of them are amazing public servants who are occasionally even heroic. And I also have sympathy for the argument when we're talking about police review boards in general. When those police review boards don't have law enforcement experience, I think they can be dangerous. I'll give you an example of that. We would, in the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General's office did when I was there and still does, investigate any shooting by a police officer to determine whether it was possibly criminal or whether it was justified. We would interview witnesses in those investigations who would say things like, I don't understand why they shot him. Why didn't he aim for the legs? Anybody who has any firearms training at all knows you can't do that. And anybody who's ever had any police training would know that what you're trained is, A, you leave your gun in your holster unless you have cause to fire it. And cause to fire it means you believe that your life is in danger. And if you believe your life is in danger, why would you aim for somebody's legs? So the reason I'm bringing that up is to just show that there is a perspective born of experience that people without law enforcement training just simply don't have, which is not an argument against greater disclosure, by the way.
I'll tell you these two things. Number one, I know that at least for the mandated police accountability boards that are starting to be stood up based on the legislation, all of the people on those boards, while they're picked in different ways in different places and it's all kind of weird, they all have to go through, you know, some sort of training to get that thing. However, I interviewed about a month ago a professor of sociology from the University of Arizona who wrote a book, her dissertation turned into a book, about police academies.
Okay.
And how police academies train their cadets. And it was very illuminating, because the issue is, I agree with you, it's stupid. If you're in a situation where you got to fire at somebody, whether you're a cop or anybody else, it's bad. You're just looking to hit something.
Right.
You know, that's stupid, a stupid thing to say.
Right.
However, the rules that govern whether you think you can fire or like where the threshold is, mm-hmm. where people are under threat or somebody else is under threat, are they're so wide that you could, anything could go through it. The problem is that we teach, and that's the problem, saying that people don't understand what they're doing. Yeah, because what we're telling them is fucking crazy.
Well, I know
we're telling them that if they make a furtive move, mm-hmm. if they walk, there's a way that they talk about the gait of how people walk. They have a name for it, like, hey, he's doing that walk, mm-hmm. or he's doing a furtive move, or he's like, you know, all of that stuff.
He's sagging his pants.
He's sagging, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the problem, Steve, I think, is that dynamic that you're talking about is that people don't understand what they're doing. Yeah, because what they're doing is lunacy as far as, like, public safety is concerned, because we're giving these people free rein to just say, are you scared? Did the car move? Did the kid run away? Did something fall out of their pocket? Did they have a bulge in their pants?
Well,
like, just fire. Just fire at center mass.
You know,
that's how they teach it.
A private citizen in Delaware who has a subjectively reasonable fear that deadly force is about to be used against them is entitled to use deadly force. That's not just police officers. That's you and me and everybody else.
Yeah,
so
But the police don't have training to do this, and they don't put themselves in that situation. I would, that's true. The same rules apply.
Right.
But the police are obviously, based on their profession, put in the situation more often.
That's true.
And they're taught that. You have this right, so let her rip. And regular people who aren't in the situation all the time are going to be a little more judicious about whether or not they're going to fucking kill somebody. Whether they're
going to
dome somebody in the street, because I'll tell you what, McCall, our buddy Jimmy McCall, didn't mind shooting somebody in the back. And the only reason he lost his job is because he changed the barrel of his gun. Because again, hey, something fell out of his pocket. You shot him in the back, bro. But they tell these people it's scary out there, and, you know.
Well, you know, so on the one hand, we will rightly bemoan the widespread possession of firearms, legal and illegal, in the United States. And we will talk about how.
I wish there was a little more respect for them. I don't mind people having guns. I wish people, like, you know. I wish it wasn't a fetish that people have.
Well,
about like
the point I'm going to make is, right, there's everybody, including the police officers, who are working by themselves, pulling a car over or chasing somebody down an alley or whatever it might be at 3 a.m. They know the same things that you and I know, which is there's a couple hundred million handguns, literally, out on the streets of the United States, that we have one of the highest violent crime rates of any country in the world. And I'm not a police officer, but I would imagine those two facts would be in the back of my mind every time my heart started racing in one of those kind of encounters. And I don't know how you can ask police officers to be any less human than the rest of us. And sure, you can give them training.
I guess what I'm saying is that training makes them less human.
Yeah,
Well, let me give you an example. And you tell me what you think. And this was an example in the book. I asked Professor Samantha Simon this question just so she could explain this part of it. And she went through all different kinds of academy training. It's all anonymized. You know, you can't say where it was or who it was, whatever.
But it was 4 cities in Texas, right?
She doesn't say Texas. I pretty much think it's Texas. She says in the South. But it's pretty clear that it's 4 different size cities and towns in Texas.
Right.
So when they go into the sort of tactical training and they're grappling, you know, they're in a situation where they got to grapple with somebody. Sometimes the instructor, who's like a jiu-jitsu master, will take their rubber gun, their training gun, and like throw it away and push them away. Right. Some of the cadets will go get their gun, reholster it, and re-engage with the person. And what they teach you is that's not what to do. Because they grabbed your gun and threw it, you have to immediately kill them. That's what they teach them to do. What they also do is, when they have these things where people make a furtive move, like sometimes people will take a phone or a Sharpie pen out of their pocket, and in training, they'll go, bang, bang. Oh, yeah. I thought you were taking it out of their pocket.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, you got to be very careful. You got to be careful. But conversely, if you don't kill somebody in training that you should have, you get screamed at. You have to write your own obituary. And then people come in and tell people, I had to go to this funeral because this happened. Like, the way that people are trained is not human.
You are engaging in exactly the thing that I wanna call out.
Okay.
Which is,
all right.
Let's say it's true that out of, I don't know, how many municipalities have police officers in the United States? 30,000? Let's say there's 4 of them that train them that way. That tells me nothing other than that maybe in those 4 municipalities, they're crazy. But that I don't think you can skewer police officers all across the United States.
I'll give you another example.
Way.
In New Jersey, the end of last year, a guy who was an ex-cop was doing these seminars about like military training and how you go out and you know it's like special operators, but all these cops go to these like Atlantic City trainings, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds at a time. Just got exposed last year. Like this idea again that it's like, well, it's just the 4, It's just the 1800. It's just the people in New Jersey going to the class. It's just the, like, we're grasping at straws here to try to pretend like there's not an institutional problem of sending violent psychopaths out in the streets.
So you may know more about police training in the United States than I do.
I think I definitely do.
I'm only talking about what I saw from the Delaware State Police and then police officers throughout Newcastle County. That's my little world, and I just didn't see anything like that. I'm not saying they were all great, but I'm saying the very large majority of them were. I know police officers who shot and killed people in the line of duty who were traumatized by it. You know, some notion that it happens in a cavalier way, and that it's usually unnecessary, and that we ought to condemn the police officers who are in that situation is, we'll just have to agree to disagree. Sure. I firmly reject it. At one point in my career, I had to go to a crime scene because two of the prosecutors that I was supervising at the time, no, it was after I was supervising them. I guess I just went there sort of old man on the mountain now that I think about it.
Yeah, not that you were bored.
No, they called me, and they were my colleagues, and I needed to be there. They were at a homicide scene. They were walking back to their car from the homicide scene in the company of another police officer when, at a completely different homicide scene to be, that perpetrator started shooting at them, two of my colleagues. And the police officer returned fire. And I know that police officer. I know the two prosecutors, and it was traumatizing. Why were you guys so into that trial? I mean, you were there every day. Why?
Can't believe. Maybe this will be
bit.
Like a,
it was a bit.
Yeah.
I mean,
here's what you don't know, and I'm going to tell this, and then you guys can talk for a minute. Maybe we'll put this on a bonus episode. While you knew that Kathy McGinnis was the auditor of the state, like,
right?
What do you know about her? Like,
nothing.
Wagner was the auditor. Lydia York's the auditor today. I just saw her yesterday, or Monday. Yeah, like if you didn't really know anything about it, and the only reason we did was, again, because we're like stuck into like local politics, and she had a very sort of goofy, cringy sort of social media presence, basically.
Interesting.
She had like three personas. Like she had like Auditor Kathy, McGinnis for Delaware, so Campaign Kathy, and then sort of like a personal brand. So it's like where she drew the line.
When the word was out that they were going to indict her, Bill and I went to the courthouse and covered the press conference. And you know, McGinnis comes out, and Denny, and
Jennings came
the third.
Damn it, the Kathy's freaking. Thank you for saying that. Jennings comes out, and
who was
Alex Mackler?
Mackler,
because Mackler and
Kathy's
Denny
siblings and, yeah. had like a conspiracy theory involving Mackler.
Yeah. But we were at the and because for some reason, like, I don't know if people knew people in the office, but like we knew this was happening, and we were like, I can't believe this is happening. We're gonna have to. You know, we're going to have to go to the trial every day. And so we show up in Wilmington, where we both live, and fucking Mr. Razzle Dazzle has to do like a fucking change of venue.
One of the funniest parts of that it was the
unbelievable.
It was like May 30th, I want to say.
Yeah.
One of the greatest things was before that hearing in Newcastle County started, Denny walks by and Rob's like, what do you think about today? You feel good? And he's like, yeah, we got to have some discussion first, something about venue, and he kind of just rolled his eyes, shook it off.
We were right about that.
Yeah, I was skeptical, but I think it was just because I realized I would be inconvenienced.
Well,
I think you're right.
I live in Newcastle County. It's not like I wanted to drive to Dover every day, but that was the right thing for my client, and Delaware law is clear as day and has been for a couple hundred years. We define venue as an element of the crime. You have to be prosecuted in the county where it happened, and they didn't do that, and I have no idea why. You'd have to ask somebody else. And we decided to raise it with Judge Carpenter rather than wait for the trial to start, because we weren't sure if there would be some kind of waiver argument. As you know, sometimes if you wait too long to raise an issue, you waive the right to waive the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't tell from our research whether it was an argument that you could waive or not. So we thought we better bring it up out of an abundance of caution, right? That's lawyers being pathological conservatives again, small c.
Right.
And you could tell if you were at the hearing that Judge Carpenter was pretty clear that he thought we were right, which is why they dropped the charges and reindicted.
So you guys didn't brief that at all? Did you just introduce it that morning?
No, we briefed it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But only, if I remember right, I think briefing it would gives it too much formality. There might have been a letter brief a couple of days before.
Mm.
But I could be wrong about that. I know that we researched it and we somehow presented the research to Judge Carpenter. Because when he took the bench, it was pretty clear that he thought we were right.
Look, we said this, we were consistent about this during the trial coverage. As far as we were concerned, if myself or anybody I loved were in any kind of legal trouble, look, ring up McCartner in English. Steve's the guy you want.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. The one thing you guys would say sometimes in your podcast that I didn't like, and you said it a little while ago, is the Steve Wood razzle-dazzle, because I don't know how you meant that, but I will tell you that my philosophy of trying cases, I'm not trying to fool anybody.
No, it wasn't about that, by the way. It wasn't about trying to, like...
It's zealous advocacy.
Well, it wasn't okay. Magic.
Well, but like, said in a silly way.
Yeah, so if I can explain.
Yeah, please.
It wasn't like you're pulling a rabbit out of the hat.
No.
It was more like you were kicking into gear. Like you were doing the thing. Like sort of like you were talking about cross-examining.
Right.
You know, Frank Robinson, or, you know, making an argument to the jury. It was just like... You know, some people have a little, what do they call it, Riz?
Yeah.
The kids are calling it fucking Riz.
I think I'm too old to have
Riz. Well, I mean, I don't know, but
Raz.
Is
no,
it Raz?
No, it's Riz.
But like, yeah, we sort of meant it in that vein.
Because I think
the fact of the matter is that, I mean, obviously I'm working with ODS now, and we're underdog people. We're sort of like critical of the police, critical of the criminal justice system, as we said. So
right.
We're going to already be we have a predisposition to be rooting for the defendant.
Yeah.
And so when we see someone go up in a competent way with their buddy on the ones and twos over there, like you had a Carl Stomberg over there too, who was throwing
up. His name is Marty Zinkel.
Marty fucking killed it. And so you and Marty were doing the thing, and it was like, okay, I mean, you get what you pay for.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Because the reason I objected to the razzle-dazzle thing, I'll tell you, is that what I try to do as a trial lawyer, and I've tried this my whole life, you know, for good or ill, is to line up the facts, which I am unable to create. They are what they are. Is to line up facts in a way that makes logical sense and shine the light on them and explain them in a way so that the jury understands them. But I can't change the facts. I mean, lawyers who think they can change facts, to your earlier point, are arrogant fools. You can't. All you can do is work with what you have. And so that's sort of, if I heard razzle-dazzle is like pull the wool over somebody's eyes, which is like the exact opposite of what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I don't think we meant it like that at all.
I'm trying to like get the brightest flashlight I can and shine it on something until people say, oh, okay.
But you can do that. But I think, you know, respectfully, you can do that in a way that's sort of dry, or sort of plotting, or you can do it in a way where Judge Carpenter has to be like, Mr. Wood, take it easy. And that's like, you know what I mean? There's a bunch of different ways to do it.
Yeah.
And that you did it the latter way, not the former way. And again, I think that there's something to that. Like, because you are making an argument in front of the jury.
Right.
Like, what's the point of going in there? And Bill and I have now gone to some arguments in the Supreme Court. We were there when you argued this in the Supreme Court.
Right.
I've been to the Supreme Court a couple times since then. And you can just do the 15-minute, 20-minute da-da-da-da-da-da for the judges. But when you're doing it for the jury, you gotta feel it. You know, you got to be like, this is what we're doing. This is what I, this is how I'm presenting this,
right,
this story based on this, 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 and this that we've proven or that has come to evidence. And yeah, so you know.
So jury trial work is different. And actually,
does that make sense too?
Yeah, I don't, because
and if we meant that we thought you were lying, I would just tell you we thought that, but yeah. we didn't think that at all.
No. I mean, I hope I've never said anything in a courtroom that I didn't think was completely true. I hope so. I hope that's right. What I'm trying to think of the condensed version of this. People fly me around the country to say for a long time what I'm about to try to say in 30 seconds, which is this.
Well, you can take as long as you want.
No.
It's to teach new police cadets.
No.
First thing is fire first, ask questions later. We investigate ourselves. It's fine.
I work with a group that's called the National Institute for Trial Advocacy, which is a not-for-profit group of trial lawyers who have developed a methodology to teach trial advocacy, who are trained to teach trial advocacy, and then go and teach trial advocacy because of a general recognition that the state of the trial bar is not great. There's a lot of lawyers trying cases who should be better if you want to make sure that people are getting fair trials. And one of the things I've learned from doing all of that stuff is how incredibly, insufferably boring I am as a trial lawyer and how boring all trial lawyers are, because what you are is somebody standing up in a suit yammering, and except for the two of you guys, nobody else watches C-SPAN. And that's what I just described, right? It's boring. And the reason it's boring is because human senses had the original purpose of detecting change in the environment, right? A million years ago, something's rustling in the jungle behind Australopithecus afarensis, and our proto-hominid ancestors had to know, well, is that something that maybe I can eat or something that's coming to eat me? But if there was no stimulation, if there was no change in the environment, there was no resource to exploit, no threat to your survival. And so you relax, and we now call that boring, right? And that's why if you want to go to sleep, most people will eliminate sensory input. And so if I'm in a courtroom, an oral argument in the Supreme Court's different because it's 20 minutes long. But if I'm in a courtroom for, you know, 3.5 hours and then lunch and another 3.5 hours, it is inevitably boring. And so the challenge, and if people are bored, they're not paying attention. And that's, I'm not saying that in a condescending way. That's true of all human beings everywhere. If you're bored, you're not paying attention. Your mind wanders. Well, if your mind is wandering, then you're not listening to what the witness is saying or what I'm saying. And I can't shine the light on facts if you have your eyes closed when I'm trying to do it. So what I think maybe what you saw me doing is using the meager skill set that I might have that is designed to introduce change into a courtroom environment so that people will simply pay attention. And I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm just trying in a polite way to recognize our common humanity, which helps me know I'm boring and the people I'm talking to are bored, and I'm trying to fight against that challenge. So another tangent, I guess, but that's maybe what you saw sometimes.
What our fans were just treated to and our listeners were just treated to is a definition of razzle dazzle from the man himself.
Live to tape.
You live to tape.
I guess, should I say thank you?
I mean, you can. Yeah, that was. I'm glad you said that, because that is how we.
You could say
it.
Objection asked and answered.
Yes. Yeah. Sustained.
I got some of those. Not too many. Yeah. Do I object too much?
I don't think
Not
so.
That I recall. No,
okay, cool. I don't think so.
It was just the right amount.
It was right in that pocket.
Yeah. Well, that's where you got to be, man. That's where you got to be. That's for sure.
Well,
I appreciate. You know what? I do appreciate that you all were there every day, only because it's going to sound like flag waving stuff again, except that I believe it's true that journalism defined very broadly is absolutely essential to a functioning democracy. When you take away journalism, you cannot have democracy. And American journalism now proceeds from this badly bent spine where people like the New York Times or Fox News or the Washington Post pretend they're not biased, and they're biased as hell. and that makes people not trust them. On the other hand, you guys are biased, but
we're just telling you up front. You know, we try to tell you,
which is fine. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make.
Still a primary source,
right? So here I am, a Hunter Thompson fan, and Hunter Thompson, as you are, and Hunter Thompson and I probably have nothing in common politically, but I totally respected the dude because he said, "I'm going to tell you the truth as I see it, and my perspective is warped, and here's how it's warped, and you can consume it or not." And so, as I got to know you all through talking to you and through listening to the podcast and confession, I did listen to them during the McGinnis trial.
We know everything.
Yeah, right. I thought, all right, this is cool. This is like old school journalism, because this silly idea of objective journalism is a relatively new one in American journalism. And I'm not complaining that the New York Times is badly biased. I'm complaining that they just won't admit it, which
is a fraud. Always said this to everybody, even people locally. What we've tried to do in here is to be like, yeah, I mean, we have a point of view. We're very clear about that.
Yep.
And you can assess it. You can assess that point of view however you want to. And then you can also assess the stuff we're telling you however you see fit. You know, you go back and look at the work we did and the stuff that we're saying. Is it, you know, do you believe it? Did it seem right to you? Do you like that's
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Like I because I think that's a fairer way to do it. Like I don't want to pretend, sort of like you were saying, like you don't admit it. Like I don't want to pretend that I don't have ideas that obviously I have. And so I'm going to give you the information through the way that I want to do it and take it the way whatever you want. If you think it's bullshit, just fucking don't listen to it. I don't care. You know.
Right.
But I do appreciate the thing. And actually, if you appreciate this kind of work, you know what to do. You can go to Highlands Bunker. You can go to patreon.com/Highlands Bunker. You can look, $10 a month is going to sustain us like crazy. We have gotten a little bit of a boost lately through our Court of Chancery corporate stuff. Thank you. We also do something called the Delaware Call. We follow, you know, a lot of different stories. We have fun ones, culture, law, articles, commentary, all that stuff. You can go there. You can hit donate. That's a nonprofit. You can write that off on your taxes. Perfectly legal. Steve, thank you so much for doing this.
My honor. This
rules.
This was great.
This was great. We had been talking for a little bit about like what special thing we can do for the 300th, and I think this really hit it.
Well, bring in a conservative Republican libertarian for your 300th show.
Well,
right.
Look, I mean, you
why not
know.
Get weird?
Well, Bill, thank you. Carl, thank you for everything you've done.
Thanks,
all
Carl.
Of these 300 episodes, actually. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. Everybody else, we'll see you soon. And no matter what Steve Wood Esquire says, left is best.